Blog Talk Radio.
The whole world's coming to an end, Mal.
The angels, Mickey. They're coming down for us from heaven. And I see you riding a big red horse. You're driving the horses, whipping them. And they're spitting.
All right, well, you're listening to The Unknown Show. I'm your host, Bud Smith, and I always play very cliche music. Today, got a pretty cool show. We got a few really great guests. Joseph Kintella from W. Chaps will come on. Antoine LeBouf from La Bibliothèque Fantastique. And also, you know, you guys all know it's my MO to pronounce everyone's names wrong and fuck up all the details about their great projects, so you know I'm going to do that. So I can't wait to get these guys on so they can say their names right. Tell all you that, all of everybody how to say their names right. They were on the show asking that Eddie Rath, and he was scammed, and he has a whole bunch of scam topics to cover here. These guys are all going to be talking about their great efforts in publishing, small press publishing, or in general. Our first guests on the show are going to be Joseph Kintella and Antoine, and they are calling in live from a gallery in East Village of New York City, and it's like a live event. I got some people in the gallery down there drinking some beers. I think we're gonna jump right to that. We'll start talking to those guys and see what's going on with all that. So I'm gonna stop this music and I'm gonna see if I can pull your
Thank you.
Hey, you guys up?
Hey, you guys up?
Hey.
Hi.
Can you hear us?
Hey, yeah. How's it going over there?
Yeah, how's it going over there?
Going good. It's cold.
Yeah, even
in the gallery, it's a little bit chilly. I mean, it's not too bad. But
we're drinking beer so we get warmer.
Yeah.
Drinking warm beer.
We were comparing this to ice fishing a little while ago. I'm from Minnesota originally, so it has some similarities.
That's great. Can you guys explain what's going on there tonight for the listeners?
We decided to do this event as a performance for my show. This is Antoine Lefebvre speaking. That is called When Nothing is Done, Nothing is Left Undone. And so I designed a special table shop so that the discussion can happen around this table. And we have here Philippe Notre-Dame that just entered, who is the director of the Homeless Museum. And maybe you can present the
Barbara Rosenthal is here with us. She's an artist here in New York. And David Earls is here, a musician from Montreal. It's a small crowd because of the cold. I'm Joseph Kintella from Deadly Chaps Press, and representing Deadly Chaps Press as a publisher of art.
Very cool. You guys are having a great old party over there. That sounds awesome.
We are.
Oh, we still have a beer.
Joseph, can you kind of describe the art show a little bit more?
Yes. So Antoine's show has two parts for it, Les Mots, which are composed of lithograph prints that he wrote the same word over and over and over and over and over again. One of them is called a queer, which means to write. There's actually a second queer in the show. What is the name of this one again?
This one is Paysage Landscape, and it's written air on it, which means to wander.
And then Noir Saint Noir is
a famous saying by a French singer, Johnny Hallyday.
It's part of that. And then there's a second series, and you'll have to remind me the name of the second series.
doesn't have a name.
It doesn't have a name, which is great.
Nice.
And it is a print that he's reproduced over and over again that is found on the liquor vats in New York. And so you might be familiar with the design. It's what he did the tabletop in. It's like a black and silver, black and silver, black and silver crossed over. So he reproduces this over and over again as kind of a search of an image of nothing. Would that be accurate?
Yes.
I love the idea that a search of an image of nothing. That's great.
Yes, it's a search for nothing there. That's what the title is about. It's a saying by the Tao, when nothing is done, nothing is left undone. So that's what I'm trying to do, you know, meaningless artwork, you know.
If it wasn't meaningless already.
That's fantastic. I'm excited. I'm excited to come down and see some of this art in person. The gallery's open, so anyone in the public wants to come out and check it out.
Yes, the show is on until I go back to France the 15th of January, and it's open weekends and Monday, noon to 7, and it's on 215 East 5th Street.
Between 2nd Avenue and Bowery, coming from Bowery, it's the fourth tree on the left, and then you look down at the basement gallery. And Antoine didn't mention that he has a finissage occurring on Tuesday the 14th from 6 to 9 p.m. again, and he'll be rearranging the entire show for the finissage. Part of his experience here has been the owner of the gallery, Katie Payton, invited him to come down for a one-month residency, so it's been a work in progress. And he's producing a catalog of the show that will be presented in that finissage.
Very cool.
Very cool.
Very cool.
Very cool.
So you have some great other things going on over there tonight. You got musicians that are hanging out?
We have musicians, artists, writers. You know, everyone tonight has become part of a book. I registered an ISBN through Deadly Chaps Press for this evening, and so while nothing is actually being printed, we, on a conceptual level, are within a book right now, and you're within the book, and Antoine's within the book, and we're all characters in the book right now, a book of shared experience, if you will.
Yeah, that's the way it goes.
Yeah, that's the way it goes.
We're talking about publishing as an art form in itself, beyond even the conceptual idea that you're proposing here for this book. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about how you're approaching your publishing now. What are you thinking about when you're putting out stuff for other people?
We'll take turns answering this one because we both pointed to the other to respond.
It's not a good idea of publishing as an art form in itself.
Barbara wants specifically to respond to the idea of publishing as an art form itself, and I think that's actually an interesting question. It's something that I think Antoine and I actually do differ on just slightly. I come from a perspective that genre is very important to me. I think art is art and literature is literature and publishing is publishing. Barbara likes that idea. But I think that there are, even though those are useful terms, those genres are useful terms for defining certain actions and approaches to certain common goals. And so there are times when these genres come into interaction or even disguise themselves as each other, or, you know, art plays the persona of publishing. So from my perspective, art publishing, Barbara just says what?
Art plays the persona of publishing.
Exactly. So art wears a mask and presents itself as publishing, or publishing wears a mask and presents itself as art for certain reasons. Exactly. So, for instance, in say my book dress project, I was making books, presenting them as art, but to me it was a publishing project, and I was taking ISBNs out on all these dresses made of books, and to me they were just simply single edition books. I'll let Antoine take a shot.
Yes.
What I'm aiming for in my project called La Bibliothèque Fantastique is somehow to do art without the question of the representation. There is this artist that is really important to me, and his name is Bernard Bruno, and he's doing house painting as an artistical practice, because he has been an abstract painter for a long time, and when he became a house painter, he discovered that it was the only way for him to do painting without having representation involved. So when I'm saying that I'm doing publishing as art, I mean it in this way. I mean it in the way that I'm not representing myself publishing as art, I'm just publishing. And this is the art, like a ready-made activity.
Barbara wants to know why you got that.
What is that the goal of it, or the underlying driver?
The goal of it is to take art away from the representation, so that art can be the closer as possible to reality and to everyday life. And so art would be dissolved in everyday life if it's not the opposite.
Why do you want that to happen?
Because I want art to be every part of my life.
But wouldn't dissolving it make that not happen? Wouldn't that be the reverse?
Actually, there are two ways to see this.
Yeah.
Art dissolves in real life, or real life dissolves into art.
I'm opening an Antoine of beer. Speaking of art dissolving into real life.
Cheers.
There, I think the way I was asked the question when I asked you about thinking about publishing as an art form itself, when I think about that statement, I think of it as like, if I'm a writer and I'm going to write my own stuff, that's one way. But if I'm working on someone else's book, I physically put away my act of creativity from the writing and focus more on just helping them, you know? So, that's I probably have a much more stupid American view of it.
Well, I mean, I think there's certainly creative value into the editorial process or the publishing process.
Mm-hmm.
Again, from my art as art perspective, I wouldn't necessarily consider it to be art because it's attempting to do something that is different, I think, from what art attempts to do,
sure.
Which is to elicit thought, emotion, or feeling through deployment of imagery, of visual imagery. But some of those same tools are used by a publisher or by an editor. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. Wow, you guys are great. You guys all have these awesome views on such a topic. I'd like to get in a little more about, if you don't mind, tell me a little bit more about Deadly Chaps. What's going on with Deadly Chaps?
Well, Deadly Chaps Press does a number of things. We operate with a number of imprints, which an imprint in the publishing world means, it's the same publisher, but there are different subdivisions that have different missions. And so each one of our imprints has a different mission. We have Short, Fast, and Deadly, which is our literary magazine. We have Dr. Faustus and Company, which is a series of art books that was just launched. Barbara is actually publishing her Cold Turkey at the Dog Run with us later in spring.
Thank you.
No problem. We pushed that back a couple times. Deadly at Chef's Press does a chapbook series. The 85 series is a series of art books where I send a 20-page blank book to an artist or a poet. They get to fill it in 30 days, and then I publish it exactly as it is returned to me. I scan the pages rather than actually exercising any editorial art with it, and so I present it exactly as they gave it to me. So we have a different approach in that sense from La Bibliothèque Fantastique, which is I think it has one central mission, right?
But there are also different imprints in La Bibliothèque Fantastique. There is also something that is common, is the fact that you don't want to choose, you don't want to do any layout for these A5 books that I have one in my hand. And I did the same kind of thing for La Bibliothèque Fantastique, as I asked to every artist that I'm publishing to choose the cover of an already existing book and to transform it into his own cover for his book. And so this way, I did this to avoid having to take graphic design decisions. And this way,
let's call it what it is. You did it to avoid having to do extra work.
No, because it's also a graphic design work, you know, to transform the cover, to erase the name of the original printer, the original publisher. And but it was a way to avoid decisions.
And I will say that, well, I actually did the A5 project to avoid doing work. It actually turned into more work because I had to print the blank books. I had to scan what was returned to me, individual pages, reassemble them into a PDF. So I ended up doing more editorial work for A5 than it hurt.
In your book, the artists were given free reign to do whatever they wanted in the book. In yours, you actually asked the artists stop doing their own work and turn their focus to your...
Did I?
Thank you. Well, I'm asking you. I think you did. You said you asked the artist to take a cover and read it.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever they might have been doing on Monday, you asked them to stop doing that
no,
and
usually
turn their brain into your ideas of what you wanted done to, in order to participate in the project.
Most of La Bibliothèque Fantastique's books are artist books, and therefore I do not ask artists to do anything special except what they want to do in the book. The cover part I usually do myself. I just ask them which book corresponds the most to what they do, and sometimes the cover doesn't have anything to do with what's inside of the book. Sometimes, like this one that we have in front of us, Jérémy Benquin, Un coup de déjaménal volé à l'hasard, sometimes the whole book, the whole original book that is transformed. And for this one, Jérémy Benquin chose to make this poem, this very famous French poem, disappear. So the name of the poem in English is A Throw of a Dice Never Will Abolish Chance. A throw of a dice.
The throw of the dice will never abolish jam.
Exactly. And so this artist chose to make this poem disappear by throwing dice. And so it's a performance in which he throws dice, and I erase the syllable we count, depending on the number coming out of the dice. We count and erase the syllable that corresponds to the count. And we have done that until the poem was almost completely blank.
I love how you just said the number coming out of the dice. That's a performative way of thinking about a role.
I'm curious, does anybody there want to read anything? You got anything you were interested in reading?
Wow. Oh, no. What a question.
Yeah, right.
Turn to a random page, read something.
It's not my shit.
David, you're welcome to read.
No. You guys go ahead.
I can read very poorly in French.
Oh, yes. That's
good. That's entertaining, right? I'll read from this erasure text. Portion quelques manoeuvres à l'âge oublié. Ja, il est poigné, pareil. Everyone is cracking up here as an aside.
Sound like me.
Yes, the raison unanime. So that is from Un coup de déjeuner, Navalera, de Hazard, and now that I've embarrassed myself thoroughly.
No, it's really nice.
And that sounds like me giving subway directions at 3 a.m.
Most of the time when we do this performance, we have a reading at the end, which is also very funny because as the words are all cut up, you know, it doesn't mean anything anymore. And
yes. And
here, half of the word has syllables missing, so even though you could read French, it would still mean nothing.
Yeah.
Well, there we are back to that
word
nothing.
In a circle.
Yeah. You stated that as a goal. It was one of the first things you said in this interview, is that you wanted things to be meaningless. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
What? Okay. The backing up. The idea of art having no meaning, the art that you would like to make happen.
Mm-hmm.
You said early in that interview that you wanted it to have no meaning, and I said something like, wait, what, something like that, but it went on, so we're back there, and you just said it again. Why is that a goal for you?
I don't see the nothingness neither as a goal or as something that would be negative. I'm just seeing it I'm trying to see it in an oriental way, you know, not as the absence of something, but as a void, as something that would be a plane and void. Does that make sense to you?
I mean, I think the void is a very important concept to art. I was doing some writing about the sun the other day. This is random aside, but one thing that I wrote about the sun is, without the sun, there can be no life, but within the sun, there can be. I think that's the same as it's applicable to all concepts of void. They are both perfectly necessary and perfectly impossible.
Oh, but it's perfectly linguistic.
You think about this Groucho Marx saying, you know, outside of the dog, the book is a man's best friend. Inside of a dog is too dark to read.
Yeah. I wouldn't be a part of any club that would have me as a member.
I'm really curious about this idea of the meaning of art, whether art is important to have a meaning, it's not important to have a meaning, whether the meaning is important to an artist to know what that is, whether it's only important for the artist to generate the art, and whether it's up to the viewer, like all that.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking before the show about
appropriation, and that's something that I do, for example, for the covers of the La Bibliothèque Fantastique, and that's something that is part of this démarche. To me, it's a self art, it's a self obliteration, as Yayoi Kusama tried to do it. And so, when I say that I'm trying to do this meaningless artwork, it's in a way that I will obliterate myself in writing over and over 1,000 times the same word, trying not to think, trying not to overthink, and so that's what interests me the most.
I,
you know,
understand you. And
to suppress yourself as a human being, as a thinking being.
You know what I think?
Hmm?
I think that the analysis of that is a tremendous desire and fear on
mm-hmm.
the same half of
mm-hmm.
revealing
mm-hmm.
my position, which has been stated in print many times,
mm-hmm.
is that art is true art, high art, real art, is a reflection of the inner workings of the artist.
Mm-hmm.
My 1996 book was called, the title was Soul and Psyche, as a meaning that is what art is about. And for you to say pretty much the opposite tells me that is the meaning of art for you, that what you are feeling about yourself is that in revealing this sort of nihilistic, non-revelatory thing, you're telling us a lot about your inner self and the secrecy that you're trying to hold.
And just as a slight segue, but speaking of the obliteration of self, we're definitely drinking beers and wine around the table while we have this conversation with you. We hope you're drinking too. We're cheersing here right now. I do know that you need to get Eddie on the radio here too. So do we need to obliterate ourselves, or should we keep talking?
I want to hear some more. You guys are raising some great points. I wanted to
just bring Eddie on with us. I'll chat with him. Eddie's an old friend of mine. He's actually been published in Short, Fast, and Deadly a number of times. So I mean, why don't you bring Eddie on with us?
Yeah,
hey,
he's
guys.
On here now. I just brought him back on. We're going to talk with him for a little while, and then in about 5 minutes, I'm going to get to a straight-up interview with him now, okay? Eddie, you there?
Yeah, hey, what's going on?
Hey, Eddie.
You guys want to say hi to you.
How are you?
Hi. Yeah, Joe. I saw you were on tonight. That's cool.
Excited to be on with you. I'm interested to hear about this scam.
Where are you?
What's that?
talking about
Barbara wanted to know where you are, and I told her you were in New York, and she started laughing. It is a little funny. Eddie, where are you?
I'm in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Where
oh,
is
my home
cold.
Territory. I forgot yeah. that you're from home.
Yeah. Where I live.
Is it cold as hell over there? Because I know it's cold here, but I heard it's like death cold in Minnesota.
I haven't been outside since Sunday because it's like negative 50 wind chill or something.
Oh my God! You see, you know, I'm actually Minnesotan when the first thing I bring up is the weather. That's what we do when we're from Minnesota. We talk about the weather incessantly.
And then I'll tell you, go ice fishing.
And then we go ice fishing. Yeah, Eddie, have you ever been ice fishing? We were talking about ice fishing earlier. And they think this is very funny. I was saying that this is a little bit like ice fishing right now, conducting an interview in a cold gallery with cold beer. A is cold because it's so cold in the gallery that you don't have to worry about the beer getting warm. Fantastic.
That is an advantage. I was ice fishing once a couple of years ago. I did not enjoy it.
Yeah. I think didn't enjoy that either. Did you catch any fish?
Tilapia.
I've never caught any fish ice fishing.
So. Nobody actually catches fish. The cold is too
fishy. The
fish are too cold to eat anything. It's like a male bondage sort of experience.
Yeah, I was like 16, and my dad and his friends were there, and it was mostly just them getting really drunk, and I was like, there.
Yep. Drink a lot of beer, you shiver a lot, and you don't catch fish. Great.
Yeah. It was really pretty out though. Like, there's no, you can see lots of stars. I guess that's one advantage to being super cold.
Yeah.
But, here, hold on one second.
Barbara's going to the bathroom, just so everyone knows. We got off a fire extinguisher in the gallery earlier. It's been a total adventure, actually. But where is your studios, out of curiosity?
Where is the studios?
Yeah.
I'm uptown, Washington Heights, on 81st Street.
Ah, gotcha.
Yeah, so I'm up here right on the river by the GWB Bridge.
Well, again, I hope you make it down to Antoine's Finissage next week. Again, that's Tuesday, January 14th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Peanut Underground, which is 215 Fifth Street between 2nd Avenue and Bowery.
Very cool, yeah.
And Eddie, you should fly down for it. What the hell?
I'll be there.
Got it, right?
I promise to have just as many beers that night as I do tonight. And one, too.
It was great to hear from both you guys, from all you guys. Antoine, I'm looking forward to checking out your exhibit. And Kintella, I'm going to have to come down there and say hi to you too, man. I'm looking forward to new things coming out from Deadly Chaps also. Rob Vaughn just had a great book out with you guys, so keep an eye on new releases. Yeah.
Thanks, bud. This was fun.
All right, guys.
You guys have a good chat on scamming.
Yeah, keep partying, man.
All righty. Have a good one now.
Later, everybody. Hey, Eddie, you hang on there. We'll get into talking about some of this other stuff. How you doing? I didn't get to say a proper hello to you there. How's everything going?
Not too bad. You know, just surviving the cold right now, trying to get some work done. But
yeah,
all right.
Yeah, you know, I gotta say, man, I was you know, it's, well, you know, whatever. Everybody's talking about how cold it is. It is cold. My friend was here from, you know, my friend was here from L.A. today, and we were walking around in my neighborhood. You know, you friends with Ben Laurie, you know that dude?
Yeah, I met him before.
Yeah. Ben was in the city, and we were walking around, and it was a really amazing thing happened because it was so fucking cold that we realized everybody, you know, in New York City, everybody, you know, a lot of people walking around talking different languages, Chinese,
yeah.
Spanish, you know, French, German, yeah. But everybody who would walk by, we could understand exactly what they were talking about. And I felt great. I was like, this is so cool. Usually in New York City, I walk around, I feel dumber than I usually do. And today, I felt like a genius. I was just like, hey,
the weather brought everyone together.
Yeah, the weather brought everybody together, man. It really did. Not that we have it as bad as you. You say negative 50 degrees, and I feel like a hardcore pussy over here, but I don't really care anyway. It's all good.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not a competition.
Once it gets to be, 10 degrees, I think it doesn't matter how cold it is. It's just too cold.
Yeah, yeah. it's like, you know, whoever dies first doesn't win, you know.
Yeah.
I was looking forward to talking to you about some cool things you got going on, you know, let alone some not cool things that have happened to you recently. First I want to introduce you to people who aren't familiar with who you are. I got a little bio here I'm going to read. I'm not always the best at reading people's bios, and I try to remember when I can. This is the man I'm talking to here. You are the author of your most recent books that are coming out. Twilight of the Wolves from Perfect Edge Books, coming out in 2014. And Noor, which I'm intrigued by this. Noor, a love story from Civil Coping Mechanisms. I'm a fan of Civil Coping Mechanisms and of the guy that runs Civil Coping Mechanisms. Looking forward to that. Yeah, Michael's a good dude, Michael Seidlinger. You're also an editor at LitPub and Monkey Bicycle, and more of your work can be found on your goddamn website. So I want to talk a little bit about, let's talk about, you know, you got to pick a spot. I want to talk a little bit about Noor. What's going on with this book, Noor, A Love Story?
All right, Noor, A Love Story is actually the first novel I ever wrote. I wrote it September of 2010, so it's kind of a while ago. I had just graduated college and was just about to move to South Korea. And I had never written anything longer than 10,000 words before.
Uh-huh.
So I kind of jokingly challenged myself one night. I was like, I bet I can write a book by Friday. And I didn't really take it seriously, but then in the morning I started writing, and by Friday I had Noor, A Love Story, which actually came out almost exactly how it still is, which is kind of, I think, the most surprising thing about it. The name actually comes from this Dutch movie that I was watching that I can't, or no, Danish movie that I can't remember the name of, but it's just kind of this throwaway line in there, where the guy says, all you need for a noir is a pretty girl and a mystery.
Yeah.
I thought that was cool. So that's kind of where the title comes from. And it's kind of a magic realist novel with 26 narrators.
Cool.
And so there's lots of contradictions and confusions of facts. And all these people are talking about these two characters who never have a narration.
Uh-huh.
And so these narrators are people who didn't know them. Maybe they just passed them on the train. Maybe they were, you know, distant relatives or something like that. And so these are the people narrating the lives of these two different people. And, so that's kind of where how it all kind of came together.
Well, that's super interesting, and I really like the idea of how the book just came up, where it was kind of just like, you know, like, fuck it, you know, fuck it all, you know, just gonna do it, you know, which kind of, like, we had a really great, the callers before were really great, and they were talking about some super interesting stuff, and I really wish I could have been, you know, there with them live, and we could have got, you know, better audio, because I was trying to stay out of their way because there was just so much, you know, so much being said. They were talking a lot about art when it contains,
it creates and destroys itself at the same time, and that's one opinion is that that's when it's at its best, and that art that's just created for the sake of void is a beautiful thing. And I think that you kind of touch on that idea when you say I'm going to write a book by Friday, because you really don't have, I mean, you don't have a whole lot of time to fuck around. You just do it, and that's pretty cool. That's awesome.
Yeah, and that's kind of, I think that was kind of built, I mean, it's why it is 26 narrators, too.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest things for me wasn't so much writing it as putting it together, because I had these 26 people talking, but I didn't really have, and the first chapter of the novel, as it is now, was written near the end. The last chapter was, the third thing I wrote. So it's kind of, that kind of creation and destruction is really kind of a part of that, in the sense that, you know, you'll hear what one person is telling you and thinks is true, and then you might hear the exact opposite of that three narrators later, or, you know, there's a lot of contradiction, and a lot of it has to do with, personal identity, but also identity as an American and as an expatriate and, being young and stupid and in love.
Yeah.
And pretending that being an artist is kind of part of it too.
Sure. I think there's something to be said about being a little difficult, being difficult for a reader, making a reader kind of have to decipher something that the way of making it more more rewarding, I guess.
Definitely. And that was a big thing for that too, is for me, the novels that always stick with me are the ones that my first read, I don't... I know that I read something cool, but I'm not really sure what happened. So you have to reread it. And I'm thinking of specifically of some of Stephen Graham Jones's earlier novels, where, The Bird Is Gone, A Manifesto. First time I read that, I was just like... It's funny, I think 140 pages or something. So it's a quick read, and I read it, and I was just kind of like, I don't know what that was, but it was awesome. And on the second, third, and fourth read, it was like I was reading a different book every time, because there was so much in there. And so that was kind of the challenge, or how I'm challenging the readers of noir love story, is trying to make a novel that is constantly rereadable. And also, you can read it in any order. Like, I put it together in a certain order, but that's just how I think it... is most interesting for a reader, but, you know, you could start at the back and work forward, and I think it might be a different novel, but I think it still works in a similar way.
I think that reminds me, I haven't read your book yet, but that whole idea kind of reminds me of how awesome, for people who haven't read it, you got to read Pale Fire by Nabokov. This great book that's just a series of almost like, it's almost like getting lost on the internet, but reading a book. You just inside the book, there's all these little, like a choose your own adventure. Like you can skip to this part and read this, and then come back and read this, and notes and footnotes and great stuff. That's adventure, man. That's real adventure, and that's a great thing that I think a lot of writers miss out when they get into doing their version of literature or it's not literature, whatever. There's just to you know, that's great. Tell me a story. You want to paint something on the side of the cave, but I'd rather go on a weird little adventure, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, kind of bring you along in this adventure. That you can kind of choose how it shapes. And that's a big thing about that, too, is because the main characters never have a narration part, a lot of their story is sort of determined and deciphered by the reader. Because you have all these half-truths and maybe whole lies or confusions, but they're all talking about the same people and different parts of their lives. So you have to kind of figure out and decide, you know, what happened and who they were, which is also why it's noir love stories. The noir and the mystery kind of comes from the shape of the novel.
So, I want to ask you. You touched on one way of writing, and you said it almost as it was something that just popped up. This idea of writing a book really, really quickly. What's your normal what's your normal MO for doing a project? Is it far from this, what this was? Do you have an idea of how you like to work?
So I've written 6 novels now, and they've all been very fast. There's only been one that took me longer than a week, and that one took me 2 weeks, but it's double the length of Noir Love Story, so kind of needed more room. So that's kind of how I am. I'm a sprinter, I guess.
Yeah, that's cool.
Very cool. Which I don't recommend also. It's very
Everybody's different.
Yeah.
Everybody's different.
Very
we're all going to do what we're going to do, you know. That's the whole deal.
Exactly.
When is, not to keep beating a dead horse here with this one particular book, but what's the release date for the Noir?
It's scheduled for July.
Okay, great. Now, I wanted to touch a little bit. You're doing some editing work for LitPub and Monkey Bicycle. Tell me about that a little bit.
Okay. the LitPub, I kind of got in right when it started. I've been a fan of Molly Gaudry, who's the founder of that, for a long time. And I saw that she was putting this website together. And then when it started, I was living in Korea at the time, and I would post on there pretty regularly. Because back in its first, month, it was much more, here's an essay, and then people would talk in the comments about it.
Yeah.
That was, 2011. And then the website kind of got restructured into more of what it is now. And I started writing a lot of recommendations on there. I think I have, 11, which is a lot.
Yeah.
And because I just kind of started in early and doing a lot, I kind of just became one of the editors there.
Sure.
So people, submit recommendations and interviews, and I, get those online. And I also help read some of the manuscripts and stuff like that for the books. The Monkey Bicycle thing is much more recent. So J.A. Tyler, at the beginning of 2013, started this 52 weeks, 52 interview series.
Yeah.
And around April, I think, April or May, something like that, maybe even later, he had to discontinue that. It was kind of when Mud Luscious Press was closing down, and he just kind of needed to, focus on other things. So he asked me if I would take over. And so I did, the last half of the year of that, weekly interviews with a lot of people, which was super fun, but also frustrating and kind of, hectic. But
well, the worst is, I know from doing interviews, you send people questions and, and just never, they request an interview from you and then they never answer your questions. It's like, hey, fucker, this is how it works. You got to answer these things and then I'll post them somewhere for other people to read. Cause and effect.
Yeah, and one thing I'm really happy that I did that is it caused me to read a lot more people than I would have probably read, or a lot of different people. Because usually I try to kind of keep up with what's coming out during that year, but I'm usually 6 years behind.
Yeah.
So this kind of forced me to read things that were coming out or had just come out within a year or two to kind of. Because who wants to hear an interview about a book that someone published 10 years ago?
Yeah, it happens.
Kind of like,
hey, it happens
what about
too,
the rest of my books? Yeah.
Yeah.
So then after, as that was kind of concluding, Steven Seidman, the editor there, asked me if I would like to stay on as the interview editor.
Mm-hmm.
So I just started doing that. So I'm kind of still interviewing people. And if you have an interview with anyone out there, send it to me. I'll try to get it on the website.
Very cool. Yeah, I mean, I myself, I love reading interviews. I like reading interviews with people who usually don't get to read about, people who aren't writers, people who have weird jobs and stuff, That's bullshit, I would love to see an interview series of just people, you know, garbage men and helicopter pilots and, you know, guys that are in weird little motorcycle clubs. I want to learn about that stuff. You know? I'm getting less and less interested in the small press writer. Press and company excluded, of course. So,
yeah, I know what you mean, though. I think about that a lot because in a lot of ways, you know, the small press community is awesome and I love it. But in some ways, I feel like it's kind of constantly in dialogue with itself, which is, you know, is cool. And I've met so many great people because of that kind of, like, internality of it. But sometimes I feel like its scope is limited to writers talking to writers about writing.
I mean, we could definitely talk about some other stuff right now. We could talk about, you know, the many different kinds of animals I've run over with my car. We could branch out with this interview. But what I want to cover now, unfortunately, it's more small press bullshit. Not really bullshit. I contacted you because this story really intrigued me and really made me fucking wanna support your cause. I want to talk about what happened to you. You got scammed, and I'd like to talk about you have an Indiegogo campaign right now, collecting donations, rightfully deserved donations. Could you explain to people listening what happened to you here with your scam? How did you get scammed?
Yeah, so I'll try to keep it pretty quick.
Sure,
but in November, I'm a freelancer. That's what I do for a living now. I freelance, edit, and ghostwrite and things like that, all kinds of stuff. And I went to elance.com, which is a freelance website where people post jobs that they need done. Freelancers bid on a project. So you say, you know, this is who I am. These are my qualifications. I will do this job in this amount of time for this much money. And then they can decide, you know, if they want to work with you. So I did that for this guy who went under the name of James Reed, which is a fake name. Yeah. The first time I spoke to him, I knew that. He actually called me on the phone through Google Talk, which is like, but he had a Middle Eastern accent, and I mean, that doesn't seem strange to me that he would go by James Reed, because living in Asia and living abroad, you meet a lot of people who, if they think that their name's difficult for an American to pronounce, they just use an English name.
They just make
name.
It easy. Yeah.
Yeah. So that, you know.
Well, you see me, man. I have a hard enough time with somebody with a simple name, so I think I probably even said your name wrong, so, you know.
Don't worry about it. But I posted about he wanted this book written. I posted about it. He sent me a message back, and we kind of started talking from there. He said, you know, hey, I'll send you a check in advance, and you know, then do your work. And once you know the money gets figured out, whatever. So he sent me this check, which I mean, it was a real check, or it was a real check, but it wasn't from this company. So it was a company check. Like, I mean, I'm not a bank, so I guess I don't really know what a real check looks like.
Sure.
It looked real to me. So I was like, you know, okay. But he sent it for about $1,800 too much, and I contacted him back. I was like, hey, you know, you sent this amount, you're supposed to send this one. And he goes, oh, yeah, that was my accountant's fault. You can just deposit that money and then withdraw the extra and send it onward. So I did that. I deposited the check. I waited for it to clear. The money became available in my account, and I sent on the remainder to his alleged associate. 3 days after that, it turned out that the check was fraudulent.
Yeah.
So it withdrew all the money from my account, $2,000.
Yeah.
So withdrew all of my money, and I told the guy that his check bounced. He sent me another one.
Yeah.
And when I deposited that one, the bank closed my account. So at that point, I was without any money, with now $2,000 of debt,
yeah,
and I don't have a bank account, and I can't get in touch with this guy because he's gone. I'm talking to the bank, I'm talking to the police. Police tell me that they're not going to catch this guy, not because they don't want to, but because the chances of them catching it are almost non-existent. Like, all I have is a fake name and a fake email address, or a temporary email address. So there's not a lot they can do. I talked to the bank, who at first seemed somewhat receptive after they decided to close my account. And but then they told me, I can have another account with Wells Fargo, which is who my bank was, but
yeah,
they will not help me get this money back. And I kind of fought with them about that. I got all the way up to the district manager or regional manager, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he explained to me that it was my fault that I endorsed and deposited forged checks, because that's how federal regulations work.
Yeah,
apparently.
Good old federal regulations. Love them.
Yeah, and he also I fought with him. Kind of, I was like, well, this money showed up in my account. This money became available to me. I can't send money that doesn't exist if you give it to me. Told me, kind of pointed me towards some other federal regulations and said, if you deposit a check, that check can come back and, it can cancel that check within 30 or 60 days or something like that. Why would I know that? And so that was kind of, that was one of the most frustrating things is, I basically got taken for all my money, and then instead of the bank wanting to help me or even attempting to help me, they basically just told me good luck.
Yeah.
And that
they
is
all,
my
they,
fault.
All, they also I mean, told you, yeah, they said it was your fault too, which is the really cool part,
Yeah. Well, I mean, technically, there were signs that I shouldn't have worked with this guy. So, I mean, I got scammed, I'm not embarrassed about that. Just it sucks that it happened to me.
Yeah, yeah. It's all good.
But, I should have been a little smarter, but I don't know what a real check looks like. I'm not a bank, and I don't have people's records.
You're talking to the biggest idiot in New York City right here. So, you don't have to defend yourself with that.
Yeah.
Basically, I was touching on all this stuff because you have this Indiegogo campaign, and could you mention how people can get there? Where do they go?
I'll just tell you how it started because
sure.
I actually didn't. It wasn't my idea. My friend was Daniel Tower.
Yeah.
Yep, he is the founding editor of Bartleby Snopes, which began as a lit mag and is now also a publisher. He told me, right when he found this out, he was like, hey, I'm going to see what we can do to help, and maybe we can set up a fundraiser. He started talking to other writers, and they immediately jumped on board. So, Ryan W. Bradley, he is a writer, poet, and artist, and he did the cover work for that. Tons of people donated stuff. There's books by J.A. Tyler, Gregory Sherrill, Alex Poutineau, Alex S. Johnson, Ben Tanzer, Susan Tepper, forgetting other things. Passenger Side Books gave a bundle. Bartleby Snopes gave a lot of things. Pure Slush gave a bundle. Perfect Edge Books, Broken River Books gave bundles. And then I'm trying to, there's a lot of random stuff that I'm giving as rewards to, like singing your favorite song, finger painting, which is for some reason the most popular reward on there. And then giving my editing and writing skills as well.
Cool.
But yeah, so as you know, we kind of poked a little fun at the small press community a little bit ago, but it's kind of overwhelming to see how kind and how generous and how quickly this happened. For, you know, a lot of these people I only know through the internet. And
oh yeah.
It's just kind of amazing. I mean, we're almost at $2,200 right now of our goal, which is $3,000.
So
and we're
there.
Just under two. Yeah, so we're just under 2 weeks left, and it's, you know, I can't even begin to thank people enough for, you know, even, you know, it's huge, and it's kind of, it's shocking in the best ways possible. You know, as horrible as losing all my money was, this almost makes up for it, and just like knowing how great these people are and that they're willing to go to bat for someone who they may not even know.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, basically, if I know somebody who knows somebody who's cool, you know, they're my friend too, you know? And
yeah, exactly.
So a few people sent me messages, you know, saying, hey, reach out to Eddie and get him on the show because he's a cool dude and he's got this cause going on. And so it's nice to meet you on here, man. I'm glad you came on the show, and I hope,
yeah,
I really hope you reach your goal, you know. I'm gonna try to
me too.
Always be putting links up here, I don't, you know, whatever stuff, you know. But basically, if you're listening and you're not sure what you want to donate your charitable money towards this year, well, here's a good cause right here. So send Eddie some cash, all right?
Yeah, I'll say the name of it right now. Just, you know, it's an Indiegogo
mm-hmm.
campaign, and it's called The Revenge of the Scammed Anthology, an Edward J. Rathke benefit extravaganza.
There you go.
So I'm sure if you search Revenge of the Scammed, it'll lead you either there or to my website. So
yes, Revenge of the Scammed. Not to be confused with the other day, I came in to my apartment and my wife was watching Revenge of the Nerds 3, which still has all the original cast. They're back. They're still there. They even got Booger. I was like stunned. I said to my wife, I was like, is that Booger? He's back?
That's funny.
It was incredible to me, you know. Revenge of the Scammed. That's what we're going for tonight,
yeah.
Though. Cool. So you got some other, you know, this is one small aspect of your life. This is one little dot in the bigger scope of things. What other kind of projects what are you working on right now? What are you excited about for the new year?
One thing I'm really excited about is my book that's coming out, which is called Twilight of the Wolves, which we mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I think
sure.
it's a very different from noir love story. It's actually kind of an inverted epic fantasy, which
mm-hmm.
is a I don't know. I'm just really excited about it. I think it demonstrates some of my best writing, and it's the thing that comes closest to how I had it in my head.
There you go.
But yeah, some other things I'm working on. I just started writing a giant monster novel, which I don't know why I decided to make that a novel, but I was watching some Godzilla movies and watched Pacific Rim again, and I was like, this is awesome. I want to make a book
awesome.
Like that.
It is awesome. I'm always so interested, like, I don't know about you, but I'm attracted to things in literature that don't really get covered in, like, when you mention a movie like Godzilla, I'm just picturing, like, all the people that get squashed, you know, and I'm picturing,
yeah.
like, the stories of the squashed people, you know?
then this will be a book for you, because that's kind of where
yeah.
I'm coming from.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I call Twilight of the Wolves and inverted epic fantasy. It's kind of the same reason. You know, when you think of fantasy books, you think of knights and kings and queens and whatever, you know, heroes doing all this stuff. So it's kind of set in one of those worlds, but it tells the story of people who are powerless. So like you have there's a eunuch, a girl who escaped a plague as a child, and then a man who was cursed, and it follows their kind of not so happy life through this epic fantasy world while wars are waging across, you know, and they're just kind of swept away by it. And, yeah, with the giant monster novel, I'm kind of trying to do the same thing where, you know, I'm not going to focus on the dudes and the giant robots that are fighting the monsters. I'm going to focus on the people who have to live in that world.
Yeah, the janitors. Talk about the lunch ladies. The lunch ladies during the monster attack. The woman stocking the cat food aisle. That kind of stuff, you know. That's what I want to learn about.
And I think that's just kind of something that has to be different about taking something that's so visual and making it into something that's just happens in your head. Because, you know, all the fun of a giant monster novel is seeing cities collapse and giant robots fight monsters. So there'll be a little bit of that in the book, but you know, it's harder to make that happen in words. So what's more interesting to me is kind of what everyday people are doing when the world's falling apart.
When I asked you what you were working on, you know, I actually, this is one of the first times in my life where I did a little pre-show. I actually asked an interviewee like some questions, and you had sent in a little byline about what you had going on, and the thing was, like you've been saying, giant monster novel, and I saw that, and I was like, all right, this can go one of two ways. Of course, it can be literally like a Godzilla novel, or you could have just forgotten the comma, and you were a big pompous douchebag. And I'm looking at, like, a giant monster novel, you know. I'm like, oh, great. Is he going to come on and come out here and talk about the Bible part two, you know. What's going on here? I'm super thrilled to hear that Godzilla stuff.
Interestingly enough, I do have one that is a giant comma monster novel, too, that
that's cool.
it kind of got away from me last year. It was at 150,000 words, and I was not even halfway done. So I was like, I'll take a break for like a month. And then that month ended up being almost a year now.
But you know, the thing is, I'm just joking around, of course, but when I was saying, you know, it's all about the way people would present the work. I'm sure if you were talking about 300,000 word novel, you know, I'm not criticizing the fact that it's 300,000 words. If it's good, it's good. Just, you know, you tell me what it is.
No, I know what you mean. You know? And man, that novel, I don't know if it'll be good, but it's something.
Who knows, right? Who knows?
Yeah. And it probably, it's just something that, it's kind of another one of those books where I challenged myself. If there's going to be 101 narrators, which is kind of why it gets so big. But once I finish that, I'm never going to write a multi-narrated novel again because it's a nightmare.
Well, you know what, man? I mean, that's admirable, not only to set a goal, but then to decide you're going to, it's like Bob Dylan-esque, you know, you look at something and you say, I'm going to do this one thing I've never really done before, or I have done, I'm going to master it and then walk away from it and do something different, you know? That's cool.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the mark of an artist moving forward, you know? I dig that.
Another cool thing that just happened, actually, conversation, me answering those questions that you send me is so I've been trying to get a graphic novel written for a long time. I've actually written two using artist artwork, and I contacted them, and they said, no, you can't do that, even though I had it already finished to show them. So this time I contacted one of my friends first. Her name's Jasmine Mares, and she just sent me the artwork, so I'm going to start writing a graphic novel hopefully soon.
That's great. I love that stuff. You know, I love that stuff, and you know, I'm sure there's millions of writers out there who they write and they just want the art. You know what I mean? You got to find these people. I'm lucky. I do this magazine called Uno Kudo, where there's like an art director who, like, you know, I can say, hey, I need some art for this and this and this, and she'll you know, find cool people who are willing send stuff along. It's cool, you know? It's neat stuff.
Definitely. Yeah, there's so many people doing such great art out there, and I think, you know, you hear a picture's worth a thousand words, and that's, you know, that's super true if you're trying to tell a story. And if you can use images and text to make an awesome story, like, that's one of the greatest things you can do.
You know what it really is. I think one of the coolest things that happened with computer art is not only did, like, you know, of course, like, you can make an amazing fake image. Fake is what it is. You know, you can, I don't mean that in a disparaging way if you're doing computer art, but it also, the computer really kind of, like, it allowed people to push their regular art a lot farther, you know, and you see these bizarre, hyper-realistic things that are happening with Photoshop, and then people are starting to paint that way, and they're painting a different way, and even music, mimicking electronic music. I've seen live bands do, you know, like, you know, crazy programmed drum beats, but it's a live drummer now. And
yeah, definitely.
It's so cool seeing how that's happening, but it's a whole other discussion, right?
A really cool thing I think is happening with classical composition now is that those classical composers are, in their live shows, incorporating kind of like those kind of digital feedback and kind of using that as another instrument. And, you know, that's something that couldn't happen before, things like, you know, the internet and the digitization of music and things like that. But yeah, I love
God
living right
Radiohead.
Now. I think everything's so awesome.
Yeah, most definitely, man. Well, you know, I've let this show go on. I've had a lot of fun tonight talking to you and the other guests, and it's time to go and do the dishes, you know, literally. thanks for coming on, man. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you so much for letting me talk.
Yeah, rock on. So we had some cool guests tonight. They dealt with a lot of my bullshit, as usual, very politely. Joseph Quintella and Antoine Lebove, all the way from France, calling in live from Lower East Side, down there at the Peanut Underground. Go check that art show out. I guarantee it to be a good time. I just ate at a Ukrainian diner about a block away from there. Vizelkas. So when you go to see this art show, go grab some Ukrainian stuffed cabbage at Vizelkas. You won't be disappointed. And thank you very much to Eddie Raff, however you fucking say it. Really cool guy. Got a great cause. Please support his efforts here to the Revenge of the Scam. It's going to be a great anthology out. Thanks to Newt Power for the idea. Nate's a great guy, great juggler, wonderful sense of humor, and yeah, good time tonight. It's fucking cold here in the city, and it's probably cold where you're at too, so most likely it's colder than where it is here, so don't feel bad for me. And yeah, thanks for listening. Be back next Tuesday with more guests, more of me saying a bunch of stuff that doesn't matter. Next week, we're going to be talking to Ryder Collins, Michael Maxwell, and Ray Bryant. So it should be a really cool show. And I hope to catch you there. Thanks for listening. Later.